Join us for the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society's annual conference. It's happening October 24th through the 26th in New York City. This year's theme, Rethinking Paradigms, Innovative Approaches for Optimal Wellness. And it's not just for healthcare professionals. Teachers, parents, and curious minds are invited too. We've got a phenomenal lineup of keynote speakers. Dr. Thomas Campbell, physician and co-author of The China Study, bringing insights on nutrition and lifestyle medicine. And Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, trauma expert and author of The Body Keeps the Score, who practically rewrote how we think about trauma. I'll be chatting with some of this year's speakers in upcoming episodes of Healthy Brain, Happy Body, so stay tuned to get a sneak peek and maybe even a little inspired. Find the registration link in the show notes. It's 3 days of inspiration, insight, and community you won't want to miss. Here's what Jeffrey Schultz, board member of NRBS, has to say about coming to New York City.
One of my favorite things is meeting people, talking to them, talking to other clinicians, finding out that they're struggling with things too, and then just having fun. Because the cool thing is we're not just all brainiacs. There's actually some pretty sweet people to hang out with and have a good time with. So I found friendships out of this. I found a lot of fun with this. And I'm just going to add that on top of it. Because if you're thinking about just, hey, I can get continuing education units, great. You can do that online. What you are not going to get is the experience of meeting people and making the friends. And I'm kind of old school when it comes to that. I miss the conferences. I love the seminars. Why? Because frankly, I just want to get to know more people and I want to learn from them and have a good time. So I got to tell you, one of the things you're going to get out of this, and you need to go. You don't want to just go online. You want to go to New York City because you'll have a chance to actually eyeball to eyeball, face to face. We're going to have a chance to get to meet each other and shoot the breeze, learn. It's a really good environment for that.
So join us in New York City, October 24th through the 26th. Find the registration link in the show notes or at nrbs.org. We'll see you there.
Welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Our guide today is Dr. Thomas Campbell, co-author of the New York Times bestseller, The China Study, a comprehensive examination of the relation between nutrition and health. Dr. Campbell is a family physician and researcher at the University of Rochester and is known for providing practical advice that uses what we eat to help protect us from the chronic illnesses that seem to be flourishing these days. We talked about how his interest in nutrition developed, studying the relation between diet and health, and his advice for helping ourselves make food choices that enhance our health. Listeners, we're talking with some of the presenters coming to this year's NRBS annual conference. Today, we're joined by Dr. Thomas Campbell, who will present a keynote address on nutrition. Dr. Campbell, welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
You're both a practicing physician and a researcher. What first drew you to nutrition as a central part of healthcare?
Well, I guess the blame, if you want to call it that, the reason is really my parents. My dad was a sort of well-known cancer nutrition researcher at Cornell University for many years. And as a little kid, you don't really know what the heck your parents do, I think, most of the time. So I was totally oblivious to what he did for the majority of my youth. But in my early 20s, he asked if I wanted to go help him write a book about his life's work in nutrition and cancer. And that sounded like a cool opportunity. I ended up going and working with him. I thought it was going to be a one-year project, and it ended up taking 3 to 4 years to do that. And we wrote a book called The China Study, which was chronicled his career and his story, as well as the research of many other nutrition researchers. And through that experience, I read hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of primary journal articles in the Cornell library stacks before everything was online. And then, you know, would have dialogue with him, this well-known, successful professor and the expert on the topic. I really got a good education about nutrition. At that time, I discovered and realized that nutrition has a profound influence on our health, and it really does affect so many common problems and conditions that afflict Americans. And in my young brain, my young heart, I thought, well, gosh, I could make a living, I could make a career out of pursuing nutrition information, sharing in the broader context of health. If people could know how much control they have over their health, surely that would be a worthwhile thing to share. So I became interested really just from my family background in nutrition, but my passion just grew as I learned about how profound what we eat is for our overall health.
I can imagine all of that research, the reading you did, must have had such an impact on your understanding of nutrition and then working so closely and in so many interesting ways, not just on the research itself, but when you co-wrote the book, The China Study, which I think most of the listeners would be familiar with, that would give you a different perspective, almost not just the scientific perspective, but also on the process of how to think about it, as well as your own sort of family background. Because I think your father grew up on a dairy farm.
Yes, he was grew up on a dairy farm, a farmer, hunter, you name it, country kid, and ended up becoming highly educated through a long educational journey, but ended up at Cornell University. When he first started teaching at Cornell, he tells a story of he did his PhD working with protein and learning about how protein optimizes growth in the broader context at the time of trying to increase protein consumption, particularly high quality animal protein consumption for human health. So his background was growing and dairy, a dairy farm, dairy production, and then going to school to optimize protein consumption for human health. And early in his career, he tells a story of learning about one of his students in his nutritional biochemistry class who was a vegetarian, and he barely knew what that was, and what the heck? Why would anyone do that? That sounds crazy to me. And yeah, through his experience, the research suggesting more plant-based diets, less chronic disease, started opening that door and going down that road. And we became more and more open to plant-based diets over the years. And then really, I think with the heart disease, some of the heart disease research out there, and he became acquainted with Caldwell Esselstyn and some of the heart disease reversal folks who were at the time around the early 90s, who were just coming out with some really kind of stunning findings of atherosclerotic regression based on diet and lifestyle and plant-based diets, vegan diets. He sort of continued going more and more into the plant-based realm, and it aligned with what he was seeing in cancer as well. So some of his preclinical work with animal models, as well as his observational research in China, showing that more plant-based diets seem to be linked to better outcomes.
And obviously for you, you've also continued in that direction with the importance of nutrition and health. For the conference, your keynote's titled Better Food for a Better Life. So when you think about better, the word better, what does that mean, at least in practical terms?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a loaded term, right? I generally strive to stay away from value judgments, good, bad, evil, virtuous kind of judgments with our behavioral choices, which is important, right? But so many folks are struggling with their health, and whether it's a metabolic condition, excess weight, high blood sugar, diabetes, I mean, more than 50% of Americans are walking around with either diabetes or pre-diabetes. More than 70% have excess weight, and a high percentage of those have pretty severe excess weight that impairs quality of life and function. And so you look at the numbers of people who consider themselves disabled, who are disabled, and it's not all sort of congenital problems or older age. It's oftentimes related to these chronic diseases. So we have, in this country, unfortunately, an aging trajectory that looks like a ramp down. You're starting at a good, healthy state, 20s, maybe 30s, but increasingly even younger and younger, you start getting more and more involved in doctors, more medical tests, more problems, and they kind of just build up. Everything over time kind of slowly gets a little worse. And then 50s, 60s, oftentimes you have these big events where people have hospitalizations or so forth. And their ability to function and do the things they love to do in their life is impaired. And when I say a better life, I imagine that what most people want, and in my experience, is what we call squaring the life curve, right? Which is having that excellent health that we enjoy in our youth continue through adulthood. And for goodness sake, maybe even through retirement. So we can travel and we can go hike the places we want to hike. And we don't need to worry about some of the difficulties of ill health until very advanced ages. And then that happens fairly quickly, which of course will happen for all of us. But the hope is that it can happen fairly quickly and we have excellent function up until then. That squaring the life's curve is a common idea. And a better life, I think, is probably more in that direction is what I'm referring to, which is having more health for a longer period of time.
So the better food for a better life, it's really about keeping the quality of life as high as we can for as long as we can, and to at least minimize or reduce as much as we can the chronic health issues that really plague our ability to function.
Yeah. I mean, let's take diabetes, for example. I mean, for a lot of people, super common and becoming more common. And for a lot of people, for quite a while, diabetes is really just a lab test abnormality that they go to the doctor, they get their blood drawn and their A1C is a little high, their blood sugar is a little high. And for years, they feel fine and things seem to be normal. And if you're conscientious, you treat your blood test abnormality. If you're not as conscientious or you don't trust your doctors, you kind of ignore them, but everything's kind of swimming along just okay. But then at some point, diabetes, I always, as I describe that disease, I say this disease will collect. And if it progresses, this disease will collect. And when that time comes, it's devastating to lose a foot, to lose a bunch of toes, to have kidney disease to the point where you're worried that your next illness might lead to needing dialysis, to go blind, to have a heart attack, the most common outcome for those with diabetes, have heart disease and have a heart attack. So living under that hammer, living under that weight is not optimal. Now, I will say, and this is going to argue against nutrition a little bit, I suppose. In my experience, if I've been fascinated by our behavior and how we live and why we do the things we do, we can adapt to just about anything. So there's lots of people with chronic conditions who have wonderful days and perfectly nice level of happiness and pleasure and joy. So I don't mean to say that any diagnosis is instant misery forever, but we obviously want to maintain our health. You know, one doctor I've heard say, without our health, we have nothing when you get down to it. The money in the bank account, the plans you had for your future, your health starts going and boy, oof, that's the foundation, right? So we need to protect it. We need to do what we can. And, you know, we don't have control over all of these important things. Control is an illusion, but we can certainly affect it.
I think you're bringing up one of, I'm not sure if the word is conflict or paradoxes about chronic health conditions, which is there are certain things we can do to help prevent or make better. And at the same time, a lot of it is out of our control, and we have to manage as best we can our lives when we have the conditions, whether it's diabetes or Lyme disease or chronic pain. As a health psychologist, I do a lot of work with people of chronic health conditions. I think one thing that you're at least suggesting is as clinicians, as providers, we need to go in there and work with what we have, work with the client, work with the patient we have. And yeah, we want to perhaps argue for good nutrition, and we still have to deal with whatever's going on in the best way that we can. And I think that often is a kind of a conflict because we kind of get these different messages, I guess. And I guess blame may be the word I'm moving towards.
Yeah.
Which is, do we blame our patients for their quote, less than better behavior? And how can we do that and still provide the best care? So yeah. I'm kind of curious how you approach that sort of conflict.
Yeah, it's a great question. Patients with cancer, for example, are really a key example of this. I know it's a very common question when you get a diagnosis of cancer is why did this happen? And it's a question with many layers of reasons, right? One big reason is if I can know why, then maybe I can do something to fight it, you know, fight the cause. But there is an element of sort of blame in that journey where there's something that we did to cause that. Then is there a blame or guilt or shame, like any of the above, that goes along with that? And yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, that has to be really carefully avoided as much as possible, because when we find ourselves in these less than optimal situations, you do have to realize that we don't have control over all of these things, and we don't ever really know exactly what led to that occurrence. And so cancer is a great example. Yes, it's quite likely and possible that nutrition has a profound effect on various cancer-related risks. And I think it behooves us to try to live healthy and lower our risks as much as possible. But when it happens, we all have different genes, different genetic predispositions. Even if we think it is behavioral, there's a lot of things that behaviorally we think maybe contributed. You got to kind of leave that behind you a little bit, because we don't know how things are going to turn out in the future. And for a lot of people, when I talk to about who have developed nutritional problems, they've never heard, for example, they've never heard about nutrition's effect on these conditions. And even if they did hear about nutrition, you can have 5 PhDs and be expert in all sorts of things, very smart person. But you go to the bookstore and my God, you see every single nutrition plan you can possibly dream up with some credible person saying, yes, this is the way. And so you have to be kind to yourself. And if you didn't know the information, of course, you can't act on what you don't know. If you knew the information and you still didn't do it, that's okay, because we have so many influences on our life that determine our behaviors, right? The people we know, our environment around us have a profound impact on how we behave. And sometimes it's just hard to change our behaviors. And that's true for all of us, right? I may eat a much healthier diet than someone else, but you know, we all have our struggles and vices, and the perfect behaviors is an illusion that really virtually nobody can say they do. So it's a long-term journey. It's worth the fight to try to lower your risks, stay healthy, stay functional. But you're right, when things go awry, we work to do what we can to make the situation as best as possible. But that, I think you, and you're, this is really your area, that mindset in my mind is more of a internal. People have different mindsets about all sorts of things, I suppose. I mean, you can be unhappy with exceptionally good health and then be unhappy with a very bad diagnosis, or you can be happy with exceptionally good health and then happy despite a good diagnosis. You know, so there's a lot of factors here. Yeah. There's a lot of things, you know, in terms of well-being.
Well, we're not going to solve that problem today. But turning to something you'd said about the nutrition, which is you can walk into a bookstore and see almost an infinite number, or go on the internet and find almost an infinite amount of recommendations and plans and diet this and diet that, and arguments for more protein, more arguments for less protein, things like that. But given how complicated the nutrition information is, if someone wanted to begin to make changes in their diet, regardless of what it is, where's a good place to start?
Yeah, so I think of dietary spectrum in terms of two axes. You know, on one axis is whether you're eating animal-based foods versus plant-based foods. And based on lots of lines of evidence, observational research, intervention research, including our own research, if you get more towards plant-based on that side of the spectrum, the more you go plant-based, the better off it is for a variety of conditions. The other axis is whole foods versus processed foods. And when I say processed foods, processing foods is a very complicated idea, actually. Like, what's a processed food? In my mind, I'm thinking of it not so much the technical sort of common definitions of processing, but I think of it in terms of food fragmentation. Are you eating the whole food versus a food fragment? Are you eating an olive or are you eating olive juice or olive oil? Are you eating an orange or are you eating an orange juice? Okay, so this is, are you eating the whole food or the food fragment? And research is also quite clear here. When the food fragments we eat most of are white flour, sugar, and oil. And the research is very clear that diets that contain less of those things are better. So more whole foods and more plant-based. And that's the term we used, my dad and I used in the China study. My dad had been talking about plant-based diets for a long time, and we used the idea of whole food plant-based. And so there is a spectrum of choices, of course, in that whole meal or your overall intake. But if you started adding more whole foods, more plants, more fruits, vegetables, whole grains, you know, the research, I think, is pretty clear that's a good direction to move in.
Pretty straightforward, actually. It's one of the most straightforward ways I've heard it described. It's still, I think, complicated in some ways, not from an idea perspective, but just carrying it out, you know, sort of a more practical perspective. So when I think about either cultural practices as far as food is concerned, or even availability, how do those things sort of impact, or how do you use that advice given our cultural backgrounds or what's available around us in terms of food?
Well, the availability thing is a distinct kind of issue. I mean, if you go to a lot of city urban areas, there's very little access to fresh whole food, whole plant foods that I've described, that I recommend. And you have to take public transit for an hour, hour and a half or something to get to that sort of urban food desert, food swamp type of situation is a socioeconomic problem that's more economic, I think, than behavioral or nutrition. So I leave that to the side, despite recognizing it's a real problem. Those people who are not in a food desert or food swamp, the barriers tend to be more about convenience as much as anything. So it's this people's busy schedule, grabbing a lot of food that's prepared outside the house, even maybe pre-made meals that you pick up at the grocery store or restaurant food takeout. And so people are doing a lot of things based on convenience. And, you know, what the reality of it is that it is a little bit more effort to make your meals at home, to choose healthful ingredients and make them in a way that's enjoyable and palatable. And that extra little bit, you know, than it is, for example, to get a convenience Kraft mac and cheese followed by a burger at the whatever. It's a little more effort. It turns out that it's quite a bit cheaper. We did a study as part of our diabetes intervention. We looked at dietary intake for people with diabetes at baseline, just what they were normally eating. We looked at the food costs of a DASH diet, which is sort of a healthier American diet, and a whole food plant-based diet, a strict whole food plant-based vegan, no added oil type of diet. And actually the cheapest one by far was the vegan no oil diet. It was like 33% less expensive than what people were spending at baseline in terms of food costs. So it's cheap and it's generally accessible if you have access to a grocery store, notwithstanding the food desert issue. But it is the effort thing. It's the time and effort that is one of the barriers. And there's a great quote, you know, and this is maybe getting into the judgmental quote a little bit. It's a little bit of but there's a quote that I enjoy that of course I'm going to mess up the quote, but the idea is, you know, make time to tend to your health now, or make time to visit the doctors later, type of thing. And it's just everybody has different motivation, different interest. It's not so much that I think everybody should be perfect all the time and striving to be perfect, because that's not where people are, right? People have a million different goals and issues going on in their life at any given time. But I think it is critical for people who are motivated to have the information. That's always been my argument. When I practice medicine, I'm not expecting everybody to go home and change their diet and go wild on overhauling their life. Of course not. They're not going to do that. But for those people who are interested, who have the motivation And there are a lot of people out there with that motivation. They really deserve to have good information. And that's been always been my goal, provide it.
Well, when trying to help people move towards better rather than perfect, it seems like as clinicians, one thing we can do is provide information. Are there other things that we could do as clinicians to help our patients?
Yeah, it's so much of our behavior is really based on things we can't influence. It's our built environment. It's the people are living in. It's our social, the social norms of society, the social norms of our families, of our friends, of our social groups. These things are beyond our influence, right? And they're profoundly important in terms of our behaviors. But when somebody is trying to take that step to change their behaviors and get healthy, there are things that I found to be useful. One is having regular check-ins and regular support from someone who's helping coach or guide them to healthier choices. So if I see someone in my clinic, for example, who's interested in change, I might schedule a follow-up with them really quite regularly, once a month or even more in some circumstances. And that's even insufficient, probably. It probably even best scenario, their intensive behavioral lifestyle programs where people attend a group class once a week or even twice a week for a period of time. So it's providing information and education, but it's also giving behavioral support where people come and check in with someone who understands their goal and understands the direction they're moving. There's also probably some benefit with accountability in terms of tracking, but there's some benefit in terms of tracking behaviors, whether it's tracking food intake in a food diary, tracking weight or whatever the goal is at some periodic time, just checking in to see on progress and how it's going and tracking the process so that you can know how to improve the process. And with that intensive kind of support and behavioral help, you can make changes despite having an environment that pushes you in the wrong direction, whether it's social connections or a built environment. But when I say built environment, I mean, it's like the classic example is you walk into a building and are you presented with a big set of stairs to go to the second floor, or are you presented with the elevator to go to the second floor? So the built environment, people have made a choice to encourage walking up the stairs. They put the stairs there in front of you. And a built environment for food is you walk in the grocery store and you see just a whole rows of junk food right in front of you all the time. Or you go, I mean, you can't go buy anything now. You go buy a piece of furniture and you can't get to the checkout counter without going through a gauntlet of chocolate and marshmallows. So you have a built environment pushing you in the wrong direction. You also have social environment where it's so common to eat terrifically unhealthy food that it's absolutely regarded as abnormal to choose healthy foods. And so that those social norms and social environment is also a real challenge. But you can't overcome those things with enough motivation and the right time and some support. And so we can be there when those people who say, I want a different direction, and just offer that extra support. But for the vast majority of people walking around, obviously, they're not quite at the right time to make big behavioral changes.
So it's the sort of readiness to change as we talk
exactly,
about.
Yeah.
And so we can serve maybe as a bit of a counterbalance against the messages about consumption and what to consume and how much of that to consume.
Yeah, it is an uphill battle. But I always think that the 600-pound gorilla or the 800-pound gorilla in the room is really policy. Policy decisions that shape our environment and shape our social norms. I watch, sometimes turn on the TV with my kids or whatever, and the commercials now on the streaming services, and just like the old cable TV, it's all people with chronic conditions taking $20,000 a month drugs or bouncing around a park, doing Tai Chi and playing with their dog or whatever. So this is the norm of our society now. And it's not, I think these messages that we get are, and that's related to policy, these direct-to-consumer drug advertisements. Food prices are related to policy, heavily, heavily influenced by policy. Food availability is influenced by policy. School lunches are entirely policy-based. Until policy changes, that environment, we're going to be fighting against that environment. there's going to be people who want to take that fight up, and we can be there to help them.
A lot of that policy you're talking about is legislative, governmental. Is there anything that the healthcare system might do, any change you would make to the healthcare system, one change, just one, that might help with this problem?
Yeah, I mean, all those policy things regarding our food environment and our food, the school lunch program, for example, is a good example of food policy, apply exactly the same to the healthcare policy. We have a healthcare system that has long favored drugs and procedures for all ills. And there's a reason for that. There's good money to be made. And so that whole paradigm, and I'm not against these things. I prescribe them. I do workups. I use them. There's benefit to them. But we can't assume that's the only intervention, the only medical thing that counts. That's not the only medicine, drugs and procedures. It turns out that food matters as well. Exercise matters as well. Social connection, all that stuff matters enormously to our well-being and our biology. But our healthcare system is focused entirely on the drugs and procedures part of it. So we have a research system and a healthcare system that is absolutely dominated by drugs and procedures and unwilling and closed off largely to lifestyle medicine, lifestyle intervention, which we know from research can have a profound influence. But for a lot of reasons, the structures of our reimbursement, which then dictate the amount of time you have with the doctor, which dictate how often you can see the doctor, which dictate whether you can see a dietitian or not, which dictate what, you know, all this, the reimbursement dictates all of that. And so as a consequence, you have absolutely an array of fantastic, wonderful people, super intelligent that you see in the medical system, that you encounter in the medical system, very trustworthy people. But the system is absolutely lined up against lifestyle medicine as one example of a non-drug or procedure-based medicine.
And interestingly, at least around the Boston area where I am, there's a growing number of lifestyle medicine practices, but many of them aren't quite as connected to insurance as one might hope to get more
diverse clientele. That's the thing. It's hard to make money. It's hard to make money doing lifestyle medicine. For one, you're swimming against the tide of the greater environment. And so there's a limitation in terms of the number of customers who are interested. And so that's a big limitation, is the number of people are interested. But number two is the insurance companies don't want to pay for that. And it takes a long time to sit down and help people change. And it, oftentimes there's a high frequency of visits. You got to see them a bunch. This isn't one thing where you just give them a handout and see you next year. You know, that doesn't work. So it takes time, it takes expertise, and that means money. And so it's not something that the healthcare system values or pays for most often. So there's a limitation in terms of customer interest, so to speak, to put it crassly, patient interest, but there's also the reimbursement barrier. If I could redesign the system, I would imagine a system where if someone got diagnosed with diabetes, they have the option. It wouldn't be a jail. It wouldn't be forcing people, but they have an option to go do an intensive behavioral support program to mitigate their risks for free. Because if we did that, then they might not have a heart attack in 10 years. But our system is too short-sighted. And furthermore, all of those healthcare costs we keep hearing about, of course, are profit for somebody. You know, that's revenue for somebody at the other end of that equation. And those are folks, unfortunately, with a great deal of influence and power. So we have a difficult time changing the system, but right now it's not very favorable.
As we're wrapping up, let's sort of move away from systems and a little bit to the science. So the science of nutrition, it's constantly evolving. Is there anything going on right now that is kind of interesting to you that's really grabbing your attention?
So my research at the University of Rochester, we've done some research with people with advanced type 2 diabetes and research with women with metastatic breast cancer. And there has been some interest, I think, in nutrition and cancer. There always has long been interest, but In our research, I'm very excited to try to take the next step to do longer studies, because what we found in our initial research is very promising. We take women with advanced cancer, we provide food and meals, a whole food plant-based diet, and we've had wonderful results. Not only is it feasible, but actually quality of life improves, perceived cognitive function improves, and metabolic health improves in a variety of ways, as well as some cancer-specific types of markers. But the research at this point is too short and too small to make any grand conclusions about, but the signs are super hopeful. And so I'm just terrifically excited if we can continue to pursue that line of thought, and if or other people continue to pursue this line of thought. And I think there is interest. I think there is interest, certainly from individuals, researchers, clinicians, to expand in this direction. We might find some pretty powerful things that people can do within their grasp and to help their health, which I think would be a wonderful service to people.
Yeah, it really would be, looking at nutrition not just for feeling better or general health improvements, but really starting to target it, it sounds like, on specific, pretty significant conditions.
Yeah, yeah.
So finally, where can listeners learn more about you or about your work or connect with you?
I'm at the University of Rochester. If anybody happens to be in New York State near Rochester, they can see me in my clinic at Highland Hospital. Anybody could, I suppose, come travel and see me, but and take insurance. There's also online, I don't really have a website. there's a couple of books, The China Study that I co-authored with my dad, and then The China Study Solution, which is a follow-up book that I wrote with my dad, more of a practical book, but it doesn't have any of my current work. I don't know what to tell you. I haven't done a great job of publicity.
Oh, well. Well, you could also come to hear you talk in New York.
Yes, thank you. Yes, yes. Come to my lecture.
It will be you and a number of other, I think, really interesting speakers. And we're really trying to take a look more holistically at health and to focus on talks and people who aren't just, we're not just talking to each other, but we're hopefully talking to families and parents and educators as well. So Dr. Campbell, thank you so much for joining us here on Healthy Brain, Happy Body. And I really look forward to your talk in October.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You are listening to Healthy Brain, Happy Body. I'm your host, Dr. Saul Rosenthal. Our guide today was Dr. Thomas Campbell, physician and nutrition researcher. He co-authored the New York Times bestselling book, The China Study, and it documents one of the most comprehensive examinations of the connection between nutrition and health. You can hear more of what he has to say at the NRBS Annual Conference, October 24th through the 26th. Find the registration link in the show notes. You can also find a Subscribe Here link in the show notes. Please click on it or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Reviews help us to get more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Colma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and of course, our yearly conference. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS and by the International Society for Neuroregulation and Research. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.